of reappearance, and one of them was the uprising of Yamani, and we have a Dr. Karimi discussing about the Yamani, and in our last episode we discussed the place where this uprising would take place, and we confirmed from Shia sources all the narrations that the conclusion of all the narrations was that the uprising of Yamani would take place from the Yaman itself. Because Yamani in itself means a man from Yemen. Well, Dr. Karim, in our previous episode, we discussed all that through Shia sources. You also shared one of the hadiths from Sunni sources. I would want you to discuss more if we have some more Sunni sources quoting that he is a righteous man.
Sure. We said that although our dear listeners might consider it a very clear concept that Yamani is a righteous and virtuous person and he leads the people and guides the people, but because of the fact that there are some doubts nowadays raised about the authenticity of such narrations, whether he is inviting the people toward Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, it's fairly necessary to share some narrations talking about the fact that he is a righteous man. He's not inviting people toward himself. He does not claim that he is an imam. He just invites the people toward Imam Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance. We shared some narrations in this regard from Shia sources and one from the Sunni sources. In another narration quoted in Al-Fitan, page 67, the Holy Prophet is quoted as saying, يَكُونُ بَعْدَ الْجَبَابِرَ رَجُلٌ مِنْ أَهْلِ بَيْتِي. After a group of oppressive rulers, a man from my progeny will come. It seems that, this narration is referring for sure to Imam Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance. يَمْلَأُ الْأَرْضَ عَدْلًا. He will fill the earth with justice. ثُمَّ الْقَحْتَانِ بَعْدَهُ. Then Qahtani will come after him. We said that one of the titles given to Yamani in Sunni sources is
Qahtani as well.
Qahtani. وَالَّذِي بَعَثَنِي بِالْحَقِّ مَا هُوَ دُونَهُ. Of course, we are not, confirming all the points mentioned in this narration. This is from one of the Sunni sources. The point that we would like to get from this narration is that he is a virtuous man.
Okay.
According to this narration, the Holy Prophet says that I swear by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that the status of Yamani is not that much lower than that of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. The other narration, again from Al-Fitan, page 245, we are quoting from Sunni sources. He says that يَكُونَ بَعْدَ الْمَهْدِ خَلِيفَةٌ مِنْ أَهْلِ يَمَنْ مِنْ أَهْلِ الْيَمَنْ مِنْ قَحْطَانِ. After Mahdi, there would be a successor from the people of Yemen, from Qahtan.
Okay.
يَعْمَلُ بَعْمَلِهِ. He will act like Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. So these narrations also refer to the fact that he is
a righteous person. The flag bearer.
Of course,
of
some of the details
guidance.
We may not agree. For example, we believe that he will come before the uprising of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. Mm-hmm. These two narrations refer that to the
Here
point
we
that
we are referring to the point that is he a righteous person or not? Yeah.
But they said that he will come after Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, but this is against the narrations in Shia sources.
All right, that contradicts with the narrations from Shia sources. Dr. Karimi will continue the discussion with you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
I can feel your eyes. Like the sun shining behind the clouds, I need a morning to shatter this long night forever. I need a hero to stop this thousand-year-old
Welcome back. You're listening to The Last Savior. This is IRIB English Radio. I'm with Dr. Karimi, and we are discussing about Yamani. Well, Dr. Karimi, you discussed about the place of his uprising. You discussed about the flag bearer, that he would be the flag bearer of guidance. And you are proving the point through Shia sources and as well as Sunni sources. Only the fact that we contradict with the Sunni narrations on the point that he is not going to come after Imam, he's going to come before Imam. Well, no more on that. We came to the conclusion that he is a righteous person, both for both these sources, be that Sunni source or be that Shia sources. Oh, the most important question that rises over here is that, do people need to go to help Yamani in case he's in need? Like, for example, people living in any other part of the world and Yamani living in Yemen needs some kind of help, of a person who can make himself reach there. Is it obligatory or is it necessary, or what is the duty of that person?
This is, I believe, one of the most important questions related to the personality of Yamani. So for sure, we prove that he's a very righteous person, inviting the people toward the guidance. He is one of the signs of the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, according to some, one of the definite signs, and according to some, one of the uncertain signs. But the point is that his uprising is approved by the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam.
Yeah.
Now, the question is that, and this is very important, hopefully we'll see Yamani in our time.
Yeah.
Is it necessary for all the Muslims, all the Shia, all around the world, just to go to, let's say, Yemen to help Yamani? Because he will have some struggles and fights, especially with Sufyani, according to the narrations. Again, our dear listeners might think that naturally we need to do that because he's a virtuous person, he's fighting Sufyani, the enemy of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. But the point is that there are some researchers, especially by the contemporary Shia scholars on this regard, and the reason which makes it more important is that some of the people in our time, they have falsely claimed that they are the promised Yamani.
Yeah.
Like that person from Basra, from Iraq. He claims that I'm the promised Yamani. And he asks all the people to go and help him.
All right.
So now the question is that, let's imagine that he is the promised Yamani. Is it necessary for me living in Europe, in the United States, in Australia, anywhere in this world, to go and to help this person from Yemen who claims to be the promised Yamani? Although he's not. But imagine that he is.
All right.
Is it necessary for
what
us to
What is my duty right now?
Exactly. So there is one narration in this regard according to which people need to go and help Yamani.
All right.
We have only one narration in this regard. Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam says, وَإِذَا خَرَجَ الْيَمَانِ فَانْهَضْ إِلَيْهِ. When you see the uprising of Yamani, then go to him. فَإِنَّ رَايَتُهُ رَايَةُ هُدَى. Because of the fact that his flag is the flag of guidance. وَلَا يَحِلُّ لِمُسْلِمٍ أَن يَلْتَوِيَ عَلَيْهِ. And it's not permitted for any Muslim to
stand against
him. Exactly.
Right.
فَمَنْ فَعَلَ ذَلَكَ فَهُوَ مِنْ أَهْلِ النَّارِ. If you stand against him, you would be one of the inmates of fire, because he invites the people toward the truth and toward the straight path. Al-Ghiba by Nu'mani, page 262, chapter 14, hadith number 13. Now, we have this narration quoted from Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, and it seems that we cannot find any other authentic narrations to have asked the Shia to go and help
Yamani.
Yamani.
What could be concluded about the duty of believers? I'll ask you that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
The Last Savior. Last Savior.
We're waiting for you to be by your
side. The question comes in my mind. What next?
What next? What next?
The final victory.
There are references to a person who will come as the savior of mankind.
I know he's one of the Ahlul Bayt and the last one, and he's going to change the world.
Allahumma.
selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Last Savior. This is IRIB English Radio. I'm with Dr. Karimi, and we're discussing about Yamani. Well, Dr. Karimi, before going to the break, you said that we only have one narration in this regard, that believers have to go and help Yamani if he asks for help. What do we conclude? Like, we only have one narration, so what do we conclude about that?
For that, we need to refer to other narrations in this regard, talking about the duty of Muslims and the Shia at the time of the reappearance of Imam Mahdi, alayhi salam. We said that the uprising of Yamani and that of Sufyani are very close to the time of the reappearance of Imam Mahdi.
Yeah.
So it seems that to support Yamani does not necessarily mean to go and join his army in Yemen.
Okay.
We may support him through many other ways, but doesn't mean that necessarily we should go to Yemen.
Travel to Yemen.
To join his army. It seems from other narrations that the answer is negative. And as Shia, we have no duty to go. Yes, for people around him in Yemen, and people who would see him, they may join the army.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not the duty of all the people all around the world to go to Yemen to help Yamani.
Okay.
And this is a very important point in our time. So this false claimant from Basra claimed that all Muslims come and aid me and help me. No, the narrations are against that. What are the narrations? The narrations I'm talking about are asking the Muslims that at the time of the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, try to go to the city of Mecca.
Okay.
So the point is that we proved that based on the narrations, the uprising of Yamani and that of Sufyani are very close to the time of reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam.
Yes.
And according to some narrations, he will see Imam Mahdi, he will help him, and according to some, he will be one of the rulers at his time. We will come to that. So the narrations talking about the time of the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, and this is mentioned in many narrations, ask the Muslims and the Shia to go to the city of Mecca.
There's no narration telling us that travel to the city of Yemen.
Exactly. So
when the narration, if we have something regarding traveling, it's towards Mecca.
Yeah, I mean, it's contradicting the claim that people need to go to Yemen when the narrations are asking the people to go to Mecca.
All right.
I would like to share some narrations in this regard because they have some interesting points. For example, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam says, "Kafa bis-Sufyani niqmatan lakum min adawwikum." As an enemy, Sufyani is enough for you. Man arada minhum, we'll talk about Sufyani later, the main goal of Sufyani is just to massacre the Shia. من أراد منهم أن يخرج يخرج إلى المدينة أو إلى مكة أو إلى بعض البلدان. If the Shia want to get rid of his, get rid of Sufyan, they need to go to some cities like Medina, Mecca, or other cities. Then Imam says that it's better for you not to go to Medina because the army of that wicked person, that is Sufyani, will attack Medina too.
All right.
ولكن عليكم بمكة فإنها مجمعكم. You need to go to Mecca because this is the place that you will gather together. This is in Al-Ghiba by Nuhmani, page 311, chapter 18, hadith number 3.
We would interpret and make a conclusion out of these narrations in another session with you. Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio.
Diverse range of programs, spirituality, youth, Eastern Tales. Roundtable Discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. Estimating the number of deaths attributable to COVID-19 around the world is a complex task, as highlighted by one attempt to measure global excess mortality in 2020 and 2021. In this regard, we have provided an article written by the scientific publication The Nature. Stay tuned for more. Knowing how COVID-19 affects global mortality rates is crucial if we are to understand the factors that govern its spread and severity, and to be able to evaluate the effectiveness of governments' responses to the pandemic. In May, a team of researchers led by World Health Organization, WHO, and the United Nations Department of Economic and Social Affairs published the first results from their attempt to estimate global COVID-19-related death rates. Writing in Nature, Ms. Berry et al. Present these estimates in more detail. Many deaths from COVID-19 went undetected in official reports from 2020 and 2021 because of limited testing capacity and misclassification of causes of death. This lack of data makes it challenging to qualify and quantify the mortality toll of short-term events, such as wars and natural disasters, as well as pandemics. For this reason, excess mortality, defined as a difference between all observed and expected deaths in a given period, is considered the gold standard approach for estimating the mortality toll of short-term events. But it is hard to find a universally effective way to measure excess mortality because there are substantial variations in underlying mortality trends and data availability across populations. Ms. Berry and colleagues set out to estimate excess deaths from COVID-19 for every country in the world. The authors report that there were between 13.2 million and 16.6 million more deaths than expected in 2020 and 2021. This death toll was between 2.4 and 3.4 times higher than the officially reported number of COVID-19-related deaths. 4 out of 5 excess deaths occurred in middle-income countries, with some of the worst affected in Latin America. In both years combined, the observed mortality in Peru was double the expected level, and it was between 41% and 51% higher than expected in Mexico, Bolivia, and Ecuador. Low-income countries had fewer deaths, mostly because they account for only 9% of the global population and have younger populations on average than do higher-income countries. Compared with the published data, Ms. Berry et al. Present more detailed methods and more refined estimates by adjusting the way in which underlying mortality trends were forecast for several countries. However, the author's estimates must be interpreted with extreme caution. This is because only 37% of countries had complete data for the number of people who died from any cause in each month of 2020 and 2021, an essential figure for accurately calculating excess mortality. There are no data at all for 43% of countries. 2% of countries had data for only some regions. 5% had only annual data, and 13% had incomplete monthly series. The availability of data is heavily correlated with income. For example, only 2% of European countries had no data for 2020, whereas for African countries, this figure was 87%. As a result, the authors had to take some problematic inferences. First, for countries that lack data in some regions, they had to scale death counts from subnational to national levels. This assumes a constant share of deaths between regions before and during the pandemic, but the spread, timing, and severity of COVID-19 within countries was far from uniform. Second, the researchers had to infer the number of expected and excess deaths in countries with no mortality data, mostly low-income countries, by extrapolating patterns from those with more complete data, mostly high-income countries that have robust healthcare systems. The researchers adjusted the pattern seen across the latter group to make estimates for the former using country-specific proxies for socioeconomic conditions. The intensity of the pandemic, each country's susceptibility to COVID-19, and its capacity to respond to the crisis. As such, half of global excess deaths were estimated without data on mortality or by using data from subnational regions. There are other factors to consider when interpreting Ms. Berry and colleagues' findings, including avoided and displaced mortality. The former refers to expected deaths that did not occur. For instance, influenza-related deaths that were avoided in 2020 and 2021 owing to changes in people's behavior and social isolation measures. The latter refers to deaths of frail or sick people that were expected to occur during the observation period but were brought forward by COVID-19, producing a temporary surplus in mortality followed by a deficit and consequently ignored when calculating cumulative excess deaths. Ms. Berry et al. Did not adjust for these factors because they aimed to identify all changes in mortality during the pandemic. Nevertheless, adjusting estimates for these numbers is essential if the goal is to understand COVID-19 fatality better. There are already models available that can adjust for influenza-related avoided mortality, and new approaches have been proposed for use in the context of the COVID-19 pandemic. For displaced mortality, partial adjustments can be made by excluding mortality deficits when computing the cumulative number of excess deaths over the month of the observation period. The adjustment is only partial because COVID-19 deaths that occur during periods of overall deficit remain uncounted. Although the interferences made by Mesbury and colleagues are not ideal, there is no obvious alternative. However, speculative these estimates, most are surely closer to the truth than are officially reported numbers of deaths from COVID-19. To rely on confirmed deaths would imply that the pandemic spared low-income and lower-middle-income countries, vulnerable populations that have limited capacity for testing and response. This assumption is highly implausible and even irresponsible. Nonetheless, the complexity of the task is apparent from the fact that similar attempts to estimate the effects of the pandemic on global mortality have given different results. For the same period, the University of Washington's Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation in Seattle estimated 18.2 million excess deaths, and The Economist magazine estimated 16 million. Finally, the complexity of estimating the effect of the pandemic on global mortality underscores the urgent need to build robust, centralized systems that allow for real-time monitoring of global mortality. The construction of such systems will require considerable global efforts to strengthen civil registration and crucial statistics systems worldwide, especially in low- and middle-income countries. But once built, they will serve as an essential early warning for future pandemics and health crises.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Family Pathology and Theological Doubts. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of family pathology and the theological doubts in the Islamic lifestyle. We know that in order to have an Islamic lifestyle, we must have a firm knowledge of Islam. Because, you know, when we want to follow something, we must know about it. We must have the knowledge, the enough knowledge about that thing. One of the issues that we see in today's family life, when we see that the people are having the issues in their family life or the family system is becoming weak, it is because that the people are not well aware of their religion. They are not aware of the theological terms or, you know, the things that are said, and therefore their beliefs become weak. So this is because when they have theological doubts in their mind and they don't solve it, and later when they have kids and they cannot explain it to their kids, we see that unfortunately some families face the difficulties. Some families, their kids face many difficulties. For example, you know, one of the theological doubts can be the religious pluralism. If the religious pluralism, the concept is not clear for the people who are the Muslims, that what does religious pluralism means, then obviously the kids, the families, they become secular. And that's why we see in Islam Muslims becoming secular because of this ideology. Why? Because they never could solve these issues. For example, another example can be the doubt about the justice, when they do not know that Allah is just. And what does it mean? Then obviously they will have these issues in their life. Therefore, it is necessary to get the knowledge, the true knowledge, and to be firm in following the Islam, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of the family pathology and theological doubts in the Islamic lifestyle. We said that when the family members, when the parents, the guardians, they do not have the enough knowledge about the Islam, then obviously the issues comes in the family. For example, the parents, obviously, they have learned something. They were believing in a God. They were believing that the God is just, but they don't know how to explain it. They do not have the reasons. They never read about it. And it is necessary to read about your beliefs because Quran is the book of guidance. Since our parents, the people, they never read the Quran, they never read the whole Quran in order to know the proofs or reasons that why we believe in God, why we believe in the hereafter, why we believe in the prophets, what was the characteristics of the prophets. When our kids go to the schools and they have doubts or the questions about the creation of the man, for example, they go to the school, they learn the Darwinism, they learn about the Big Bang Theory, and we as a parent, because we never read the Quran, because we never went through these questions, we believe because of our parents and we don't know it from the actual source, the knowledge, the source of knowledge. Therefore, we cannot answer. And there we see that the relation between the kids and the parents, it becomes weaker. So there is a dispute amongst them. There is always the father is, you know, they see that maybe like their father is forcing them to go to the mosque. And it looks like something which is forcefully being done to them. And the main reason is that because our families have not gained enough knowledge about these issues, that's why these things are happening. Therefore, if we want to have a good Islamic lifestyle, a pure Islamic lifestyle, we must go after the knowledge. We must learn these things so that tomorrow we can explain the things truly and easily to our kids, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
According to analysts, the crisis of gas shortages in Europe and the possibility of citizens turning to electric heating devices will put Europe on the verge of widespread blackouts. They say next winter we will see larger regional blackouts in Europe. The risk of industrial closures, power outages, and blackouts due to gas shortages lurks among European citizens in the cold winter, which can also lead to regional tensions. Concerning this issue, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Berlin-based newspaper Welt am Sonntag writes, a German official sounded the alarm warning of serious electricity shortage in the country and across the region. Rolf Tissler, president of the German Federal Office for Civil Protection and Disaster Assistance, said, "We have to assume that there will be big blackouts in winter. Tisler said we have to expect blackouts in winter. By this I mean a regional and temporary interruption in the power supply, adding that the power cuts were due to both energy shortages and temporary shutdowns of the entire grid to protect the entire network. The official further added that he was referring to short-term power outages, so-called brownouts, rather than larger-scale blackouts. Tisler warned that the situation could potentially reach a critical point, urging Germans to stock up on food, water, and other essential supplies. Tisler said the last couple of years have been really tough for Germans, adding that the COVID-19 pandemic served as a prime example of the unforeseen effects of a crisis. Tisler pointed out the coming years are yet to be more challenging in light of the worsening climate situation and other serious and geopolitical tensions. He said the saddest part of the news was the European Union at the confederal level denies the hardships that normal people were going to face in winter. In related news, a major German grid operator told media in early October that the country may be forced this year to cut its electricity exports to other countries in order to survive in winter. Hendrik Naumann, chief technical officer of German electricity grid operator Amprion, told the Financial Times about potentially cutting off electricity exports to other countries to avoid local shortages. Naumann said in an interview that temporarily pausing exports of electricity for hours rather than days could be a last resort to salvage the country's embattled energy crisis, which has been in the eyes of the storm since gas supplies from Russia were cut. France and Austria are the biggest importers of Germany's surplus electric power, whose energy crises could deteriorate with any switch off of German exports. Naumann said the Ukraine crisis was one of the numerous overlapping issues contributing to Europe's energy crisis, worsened by the shutdown of over half of France's 56 nuclear power plants and low water levels on main rivers delaying coal shipping. Germany's government decided in September to postpone the decommissioning of two out of three nuclear power plants in the country, saying it will keep the two plants running until at least April. Germany shut down three nuclear reactors in 2021, and shutting the remaining three would officially mark the end of the nuclear phase-out for domestic energy production. In the meantime, the Russia Today Daily reports national grid operator RTE warned on Friday, November 18th, France faces a greater risk of running short on electricity in January because the availability of the country's nuclear plants will probably be lower than previously forecast. RTE, which has been issuing updates of the situation on a monthly basis, also noted that decrease in the demand for power is making a shortage next month less likely than previously expected. RT claimed the situation appears less risky in December and from the end of February, but the month of January now concentrates more risks than in the previous analysis. Grid operator Electricité de France earlier warned that repairs and maintenance on almost half of the nation's nuclear plants may turn France, which has traditionally been a power exporter, into an importer this year. France generates roughly 70% of its electricity from 56 nuclear reactors. However, it had just 31 of them online on Friday morning, November 18th. EDF has plans to restart 15 units by the end of the year, with another 10 in the first 2 months of 2023. Some other reactors will have also be stopped for scheduled maintenance. The French government has called on businesses and households to conserve energy to avoid blackouts. In the event of a possible electricity shortage, RTE will launch an eco-watch red alert 3 days in advance, demanding reduced consumption. RTE says the risk of resorting to eco-watch system appears high in January. The grid operator warns it will largely depend on climate conditions, such as a potential cold snap or even a moderate one. Furthermore, France Press News Agency writes the price of electricity in Germany, France and Italy for 2023 has soared to new records due to the European energy crisis caused by the ongoing conflict in Ukraine. In Germany, the price of electricity for the year ahead reached 850 euros per megawatt hours in the stock market. The year ahead contract in France's bourse market passed 1,000 euros on Friday, November 18th. Compared to last year's price, 85 euros in both countries, the year-ahead contracts in both countries' markets indicate a stark rise in energy prices. Soaring energy prices coupled with runaway inflation have put the livelihood of Europeans under heavy constraints after the Europeans severed their energy ties with Russia, the main supplier of natural gas to Europe, over the Ukraine conflict triggering a dire economic crisis on the continent. The shutdown of several nuclear reactors in France due to corrosion issues has contributed to the electricity price increase as power production has dramatically decreased in the country. Also, Italy's oldest consumer association, ONC, reported on Thursday, November 17th, electricity prices in the country set an all-time record in October. Prices for electricity, which is being sold in the Apennine on the free market, have surged 329% since October last year and topped the ONC rating of the most expensive goods and services. International flights followed power tariffs with an annual increase in cost equaling 113%. Gas was the next in the ranking, with prices surging more than 96% compared to last year. Since the start of Russia's special operation in Ukraine in late February, Germany has offered substantial military support to Ukraine, sending the country billions of dollars in military aid and heavy weaponry. Russia has in turn cut off gas supplies to Europe, causing a worsening energy crisis. Germany, along with other European Union countries, is scrambling to support homes and industries burdened by a further surge in energy prices.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Role of Erdogan powers policies in recent bitter events in Iran is obvious. This is the part of speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on October 3, 2022, during the joint graduation ceremony for the cadets studying in the academies of the Islamic Republic of Iran's armed forces. This ceremony was held in Imam Hassan al-Mushtaba alayhi salam University of Officer and Police Training. The people who are creating corruption and damaging the streets are not all the same. Some of them are young people who take to the streets due to the influence of a program on the internet. Even so, all of them together are a very small fraction compared to the Iranian nation and compared to the faithful, devoted youth of Islamic Iran. However, some of them are not like this. The Minister of Intelligence recent statement clarified some of these matters to a large extent. But there is much more to this. The judiciary must determine their punishment in proportion to how much they have participated in the destruction and damaging the security of the streets.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Another issue is that from the very beginning, some officials said things or made statements out of sympathy, but without doing any research. Without having done any research, some of them accused the country's law enforcement. Some accused the police, and some accused the system as a whole. Each person did something in his or her own way. This is a separate issue. When they saw the truth, when they realized the effect of their statements, and when they saw the enemy's plan on the streets and in people's lives, they should have compensated for the things they had done. They should take a stand and openly state that they are against what has happened. They should make it clear that they are against the foreign enemy's schemes. The truth of the issue has been made clear. When you see US political elements comparing these events to the fall of the Berlin Wall, you should see what they are aiming at. You should realize that this is not about feeling sorry for the death of a young girl. You should have realized this. If you did not realize it, you need to realize it now. If you have realized this, then take a stand. This is another point.
You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The Taliban officials on Tuesday ordered a nationwide ban on university education for Afghan women. Earlier, a letter made public by the spokesman for the Ministry of Higher Education, Ziaullah Hashimi, outlining that the measure would take effect immediately in private and public universities. Today, the Taliban forces barred women from entering Kabul University.
This piece of news was really disappointing. Last night, when I was told that the Taliban have ordered girls to be excluded from universities, I couldn't eat or sleep. After so many efforts and attending several classes in hope of making a bright future, they at once ruined everything. This order is very painful and unacceptable. It has to be reversed.
This was very shocking. Nowadays, we've been sitting our final test. Today, despite knowing that they wouldn't let us in, I arrived to the university. This is very difficult for an Afghan girl to comprehend the weight of being barred from getting education. So far, I've been worrying for my sisters who are banned from schools, and from now on, I should be concerned about my future too.
Afghan experts warn that the new order will have a devastating impact on the future of women as well as the entire Afghan nation. They urge the Taliban authorities to stop rolling back Afghan women's rights.
It is a catastrophic decision to ban women from universities. This can also be seen as a terrifying shock for Afghan society, especially the youth and women. It is so bitter and concerning. Previously, the explosion hit our girl students in tuition centers, but this devastating order is targeting the progress of a whole nation. The effects and consequences of this illogical order are unfortunate and irreparable in different arenas.
And it's difficult to imagine how a country can...
In addition to oppositions from inside Afghanistan, the United Nations and several countries have condemned the order. They have signaled that the Taliban administration won't get recognition until they equally observe the human rights of all Afghans. After taking power, the Taliban promised a softer role and upholding women's rights. But today, many here say that the Taliban have been failing to abide by their promises. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Capital dwellers here in Tehran's Tajrish Bazaar, jam-packed shopping centers, to buy last-minute items and prepare for the ancient festival of Yalda night. The occasion is marked with a variety of long-held traditions, which continue until dawn.
We have came here to buy some sweets and some cake so we could celebrate Yalda tonight. You know, the Western people have Christmas and we have Yalda. I think it's really beautiful and the families are gathering together. It's really Iranian culture.
Besides nuts and sweets, watermelon and pomegranates are also on top of the shopping list as they are integral to a perfect Yalda gathering. This means the demand for these items multiply and their prices skyrocket on this night.
On Yalda, we gather in the house of the elder members of the family, and of course, pomegranates and watermelons and pistachios have to be there. Their prices get higher on Yalda, but we have no other choice but to buy them.
Yalda is the last night of the fall and the longest night of the year in the Northern Hemisphere. As is the custom in Iran, families get together to cheer and chatter, eat and drink, and read poems until dawn.
Yalda reunites families and promotes kindness. When all family members and relatives sit together, it helps sort out old grievances and open a new chapter in the relationships.
Yalda means birth in Persian. In ancient mythology, it is believed that the Persian god of light and truth was born in the morning after the longest night of the year to rid the world of darkness and wash away unpleasant experiences. The tradition is marked in Iran and across the Persian-speaking communities in several other countries, including Tajikistan and Afghanistan.
Last month, Yalda night was officially registered by UNESCO as a cultural heritage in Iran and Afghanistan, a major step toward immortalizing this long-standing tradition, which aims to warm the hearts of Iranians on the coldest night of the year. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Japan has slowly developed the scope and scale of its military forces since its defeat in World War II, despite its pacifist constitution. Prime Minister Fumio Kishida Friday announced a major shift in its post-war self-defense principle.
When considering strengthening our defense capabilities this time, we will assume various situations and consider whether the current capabilities of self-defense forces can deter threats to Japan based on the capabilities of our opponents and new ways of fighting.
Outside the Japanese embassy in Seoul, South Korea, activists protested against Japan's new military plans. Japan ruled over Korea for much of the first half of the 20th century. Civic leaders argue Japan's force buildup, to include various U.S. missiles and counterstrike strategy, can enable its military to again become offensive in nature.
The Japanese government's so-called counterattack capability actually involves preemptively striking enemy bases in North Korea, China, and Russia with missiles. As a result, Japan's principle of self-defense is completely broken, and the peace constitution, its minimum responsibility as a war criminal state, remained empty.
Japan suggests it's responding to increasing threats from North Korea and China. Over the next 5 years, Japan plans to double its military spending from 1% to 2% of GDP. And much of that, more than $300 billion, is earmarked to be spent in America's military-industrial complex. Japan's new military budget comes just as the U.S. increases its annual military spending to $858 billion. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Iran's nuclear chief announced this week that the capacity of uranium enrichment in the country is now twice as high as the total volume produced since the onset of the nuclear industry in Iran. He made the remarks in an exhibition showcasing Iran's latest achievements in the nuclear sector.
We aim to generate 20% of the country's electricity from nuclear energy and the use of radiation technology.
This is one of the achievements Iran has publicized in recent days, which is viewed as a response to what Tehran describes as the West dilly-dallying on the revival of the 2015 deal. The pact has been in limbo since the U.S. walked out of it in 2018 and reinstated sanctions on Iran.
The Americans claim that the Vienna talks are no longer a priority for them amid the unrest in Iran. First of all, they have a role in engineering the riots. Secondly, they do want to resume the negotiations, but they are trying to use the unrest as a bargaining chip in the talks.
In October this year, Iran deployed more advanced centrifuges at its three enrichment facilities, increasing their total number to 4,000. The Atomic Energy Organization of Iran announced this week that it's now enriching uranium at a historic 60% rate using the new advanced centrifuges.
As hopes for the revival of the 2015 deal dwindle, Iran says it reserves its right to boost its nuclear energy program, which it says is clearly stipulated in the accord. The AEOI says it will not wait for the resumption of the Vienna talks and will continue to expand its nuclear activities for peaceful purposes. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The Saudi coalition has seized another fuel ship bound for Yemen, keeping it from reaching the port of Hodeidah to unload the much-needed fuel. Military officials based in Sana'a confirmed that they have not ruled out the military option against the Saudi coalition in order to prevent what they call acts of piracy in the Red Sea.
I can confidently say that in the near future or in the days ahead, we will all witness an escalation of military operations, and perhaps we are going to see a one-of-a-kind military operation that will target the vessels in the Red Sea that are pirating Yemeni fuel ships which have received the necessary permits from the United Nations. The Yemeni army could also target the oil industry in both Saudi Arabia and the UAE. I can certainly assure you that the status quo is going to change, as military officials' strategic patience is wearing thin.
According to the spokesperson for the Yemeni petroleum company, Esam al-Mutawakkil, all Yemeni fuel ships are forced to sail on a path crossing near the Saudi Arabian coastal area of Jazan, where an American base is believed to be operating.
All Yemeni fuel ships bound for Yemen have been seized and fallen victim to these acts of piracy near the Saudi coastal area of Jizan, where they are searched under American supervision. This is happening despite the fact that they are already being inspected by Djibouti. Therefore, we should hold accountable the Saudi and American coalition along with the United Nations, which is allowing these acts of piracy that are causing great harm to the Yemeni people.
Yemeni military and political personnel have expressed that a peaceful solution will be impossible if the humanitarian situation continues to deteriorate due to a limited supply of fuel and diesel. Tensions are also on the rise in the strategic province of Hodeidah, where coalition forces are reportedly building up.
If there is not going to be a peaceful or political solution, then perhaps the solution is going to come through the barrel of our rifles in order to stop these aggressions.